Okay, everyone, we're going to get started with our sound bites, followed by Andreas Bausch. So our first sound bite speaker is Fernando. He's going to tell us about active particles and heterogeneous media.
All right, thank you. Well, most experiments and theory in active particle system have been done in idealized homogeneous environments where you assume that the particles are moving in a space that is perfectly homogeneous, meaning there is no inhomogeneities in there. Now, what you can think is, now if you think if active particle systems in the wild, you could convince easily that they typically take place in highly heterogeneous environments. For instance, think of bacteria, to be specific, myxobacteria. Myxobacteria is a soil bacteria, meaning that live in the soil, which is highly heterogeneous, we could say. They are also found in the gastrointestinal tract of some animals, highly complex tissue, again, very highly heterogeneous environment. So the point for us was, I mean, with Chepishko, my student in Nice, was to see what happens if you put a bunch of active particles in an heterogeneous environment. And what we found is if you look at the collective properties, is that the behavior of the system is going to be very different from what you were expecting from an for active particles in an homogeneous environment. For example, the first part there, the first figures, correspond to the study of these collective properties. And what we found is that there is an optimal noise that maximizes collective motion. If you think of the Big-Chuck model will get maximum order as you decrease the noise or the temperature in the system. Here, this is not happening due to the inhomogeneities in the system. So you decrease the noise, and the order parameter goes down. So that's due to, I mean, what I said. That's why I said that there is an optimal noise that maximizes collective motion. And we also found that due to these heterogeneities, the order is quasi-long range instead of being long range, and that there is two critical points. We also studied the transfer properties in the systems, and what we found is that if you have a large enough density of obstacles, spontaneous trapping of active particles occur, and this trapping of particles lead to genuine subdiffusion. So, if you are interested, you can come to my improvised poster, which is just these papers glued together and not all over there. Okay, thank you.
Okay, if there are no questions, we'll continue on with our next speaker, Harold Pliner. Pliner?
Yes, my name is Harald Pliner. I'm from the Max Planck Institute for Polymer Research in Mainz. We have done a microscopic, a hydrodynamic-like description of polar order in active media. We think about bacterial growth, fish school, bird flocks, molecular motors, and the like. Okay, I'm only allowed to show one page, so I have no chance to put all my equations into this page, so it's more or less a little bit prose. The idea behind that is we thought the orientational order, this polar orientational order in these systems is due to the motion of the active entities. If they swim or fly, you have this order. If they don't move, there is no order in the passive state. So it was somehow obvious for us to use the velocity of this active species as the order parameter. This gives rise to a two-fluid description because you have a passive background. In our case, a passive background is a simple fluid, but it could, in principle, also be a viscoelastic fluid or a elastomer or even an emetic liquid crystal or something like that. The point is, if you describe the order here by a velocity, the relative velocity between the active and the passive part contains the important points. The modulus of this velocity gives you the non-equilibrium nature of the state, because if you have a non-vanishing relative velocity due to the self-propelled motion, you are generally in a non-equilibrium state. And on the other hand, the orientation of this velocity gives you the structure, the pattern structure you have. And the advantage of such a approach compared to what is usually done, where this polar order is described by a static order parameter, by a polarization vector, which is then at first an simply equilibrium phase. It's a polar nematic liquid crystal, and you have to make it active somehow by hand, by putting in some active terms. In this description, where we have the, this velocity as a variable, all these active terms come out systematically due to symmetry, and even a few more than one has before. Now, I have to say there is no poster, so if you're interested in the details, you have to approach me personally or in my office, 1209. The references are below. We have also used a simplified version of this model to describe the stop and go dynamics of bacterial growth fronts quite recently. And maybe 2 years ago, we have done similar things for axial dynamic active order, where I must say I still do not know whether there are really systems where this can be applied. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Next up, Elias Putzig.
Hello. I'm doing a continuum model as well, but mine's sort of the opposite in that my system's purely pneumatic, and I'm going to look at how activity modifies the order that you see in a passive system. So, and I've also put all my equations on, well, my one big equation on the page. So, so in a passive pneumatic, you have a second, this is a second order phase transition. You have some density, which I've called one, at which a isotropic system starts to order, and then you can tune the amount of ordering by tuning the density, right? I'm dealing with the hydrodynamics for density and pneumatic order for a two-dimensional system, and it's a dry system in that I'm not explicitly considering the fluid. And the terms that I have are equilibrium terms, that phase transitions term, splay and bend, diffusion, and then the same active term that Ramaswamy uses, just inspired by the symmetry. So when you do a linear stability analysis with these equations, what you see is that the homogeneous ordered state is unstable if you're near enough to the critical density, if it has this coupling between density and pneumatic order. And so the instability leads to a formation of bands that go along the direction of pneumatic order. And if you want to hear the details about the way the bands form and the instability, come see my poster.
Okay, thank you. Okay, next up, do we have Prabhakar Ranganathan? Do we have this person? Okay, there's a question mark. All right, so we'll move on to Gabrielle Redford.
All right. So I assume most of you have seen these beautiful experiments from Zvonimir Dojic's lab. So this is an active pneumatic made out of microtubules. And I know a lot of groups are currently involved in building hydrodynamic descriptions of systems like this. One of the problems there is that you inevitably, in building such a hydrodynamic description, you have to make decisions about what terms you think are important and what aspects of the experimental system you think are relevant to the phenomena you're interested in. So we're hoping to try to fill that gap a little bit by developing a very simple simulation scheme, a particle-based simulation scheme, using just hard particles with very simple activity. And the results of these simulations are these very, you know, colorful, very trippy movies, which are a little bit hard to interpret up on the screen, but basically we see the same sort of phenomena that they find in the experiment, including the creation and proliferation of defects through the system. So we have written code to locate and track these defects, which allows us to do all kinds of statistical measurements, dynamical measurements about how defects move, and static measurements that show how they interact, all of which are things that we can compare back to the experiment. So I've intentionally left out all the details. If you'd like them, come see my poster.
There's a question.
How active in what sense? Oh, where is the activity? So that was one of the details I left out. But the way the activity enters is that the rods, each rod elongates. It just grows longer in between time steps. And so that exerts the extensile stress.
Thanks. Do we have Abhinav Sharma in the audience?
Hi, I'm Abhi. I'm working as a postdoc in the group of Fred McIntosh. I have a poster on actomyosin networks. This work actually has strong parallels with the work Michael did, Michael Murrell. He didn't talk about that. Also with the work of Kinneret, and I think with the work of Andreas Bausch also. So what we have is an actomyosin network. And let's say the network is well connected, much above the connectivity percolation point. And you put myosin motors in there. Now what happens is that these networks, they devolve, they break apart into not just two pieces, as a normal crack would do, but into hundreds of pieces, which is what is shown, is there a pointer? Sorry. So which is what is shown here, that the network is falling apart into many pieces, and the moment it falls apart, then due to the motor activity, these different clusters, they collapse, which is what is shown here. This is experimental picture in which the cluster started here, but then collapsed on the boundary. And if you expand them back in time, you see such clusters. Now, if that was it, we would be happy just to explain why and how a network can break apart into many pieces. Well, you can explain it if you have the network immersed in network with active component like motors immersed in a viscous medium. But more than that, these clusters actually follow a particular statistics, or they are actually Parlor distributed. And the exponent that we get from this Parlor seems to suggest that you are actually sitting at the connectivity percolation point. That is surprising in the following sense, that the network that I started with was not prepared at the connectivity percolation point. You could start with a fully connected network. But you put motors in there, and they bring the network all the way down to the connectivity percolation point and then seem to stop. Now, even if we could explain that, that we did, we would have been happy. No problem. But the exponent here is less than 2. And this I will not tell what's the problem with that, but the exponent cannot be less than 2. it must be greater than 2 if I want to draw good analogy with connectivity percolation. An exponent less than 2 is suggestive of not a continuous transition, but more of a first order type transition. If you want to know about it, please come to my poster. Thank you.
Time for one quick question. Okay, thank you. Next up is Alexander Solon.
So, hello everybody. On my poster, you can learn about the active Ising model. So with this model, we want to study the flocking transition, and the motivation is that the V-check model has been used for almost 20 years to study the flocking transition, and still it's not very well understood. So we wanted to have a simpler model that we would understand better for this transition. So the idea is, like, if you want to compare with the V-check model, in V-check each particle have a given direction of motion, and you can see this as continuous spins that interact with a ferromagnetic interaction to align these directions of motion. So in this model, the particles have an Ising spin, so only plus or minus, and this gives the direction of motion. So we have two directions. The plus goes to the right, and the minus spins goes to the left. So we still have the two basic ingredients for flocking, the self-propulsions given by the spin and the ferromagnetic alignment, that is an Ising interaction. Then if you want to study this model in any dimension, in all other directions, you just add a diffusion. And it's not like the usual Ising model, because here the spin the particles can move on the lattice. And in fact, you can have several particles at each side of the lattice, and even as many as you want. It's a way to say that there is no excluded volume interactions. So in this model, we can understand about everything. And the main conclusion is that the flocking transition here is a liquid gas transition in the canonical ensemble. So you see the phase diagram here on the left. And the parameters are temperature and the average density. And you go from disordered gas at high temperature to an order liquid at high density or low temperature, so particles moving collectively. And in between, you have phase separation between the liquid and the gas. It's what you see here. It's a magnetization field in 2D. And so you have large domains of all the liquids that move in the gas. And you can get the liquid fraction just using the Lover rule as in equilibrium. So the main difference with the equilibrium liquid gas transition is that there is no critical point. And in fact, the critical point is at an infinite density. And you can explain this easily because the gas and the liquid have different symmetries, so you cannot have a supercritical region where you would go from one to the other without transition. And in fact, the shape of the phase diagram here that is imposed by symmetry is very general to all flocking models, most flocking models. And then we can build a coarse grain theory that is basically a mean field theory plus correction term, and that describes very well this transition. So, and if you need more details, please come see me at the poster. Thanks.
Quick question. Let me get you the microphone. Hold on.
In this formalism, can you work at constant pressure instead of a constant volume ensemble to get a phase transition without two-phase coexistence?
Well, it's hard to define what would be pressure in this model. But we would like also to work at constant chemical potential or something, but it's out of equilibrium, maybe. And it's not obvious at all how you define it. So, but it's an idea.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Next up is Holger Stark.
So I present some work together with my students, Oliver Pohl and Andreas Zödel, and our goal is to study collective motion of mostly colloidal microswimmers in concrete settings. And the first setting explores basically the role of hydrodynamic interactions. So basically the interactions which is mediated by the flow field which the swimmers create when they swim. And in concrete we look at these quasi-2D geometry spherical swimmers in a plane. We model the swimmers by a squirmer. A squirmer is a model swimmer where you can tune it basically by one parameter going from a puller through a neutral swimmer to a pusher. And what we do a full hydrodynamic simulations with a method called MPCD, multiparticle collision dynamics. So where we really calculate the full hydrodynamic flow field, which is produced by these swimmers. And what we basically see when we increase the density for the neutral swimmers, we see a clear signature for phase separation. But when we then go basically to clear pushers or pullers, this phase separation doesn't occur. There's a more continuous transition to a solid state here. And it has some similarities to the systems basically Tutupali is presenting on Thursday. And in the second setting, slide is missing. In the second, maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe I should explain the other. No, I don't. I won't. So in the second setting, I will talk about. We were inspired by experiment done in the Lyon group, where they looked at particles or colloidal particles which consume some chemical, and these chemicals create some chemical sink. And so the particles, or these colloidal particles, they feel diffusive phoretic interactions. And what one sees basically in these experiments is that they, at very low area fractions, something like 5%, they show very dynamic clustering. So clusters form and they are very dynamic. And we have built a model for that and have found, actually reproduced these clusters. And if you want to know more and if you want to have the pictures, you should come to the posters. Thank you.
Any questions? Our next speaker is Joachim Stenhammer.
Okay, thanks, Holger, for the teaser. My poster is called Phase Behavior of Active Brownian Particles, and this is work I've been doing together with mainly David Maranduso and Mike Cates in Edinburgh. And active Brownian particles is a very simplified model of swimming bacteria and catalytical swimmers, which essentially is spherically symmetric particles with a purely repulsive interaction that swim in a straight line that but the direction of swimming slowly relaxes through thermal Brownian motion. And recently this has been shown by Christina Marchetti and Aparna Bhaskaran and others that this kind of system will undergo a liquid gas phase transition even though it has no attractive interactions. And the explanation for this is a dynamical self-trapping mechanism. So because they collide, particles will tend to slow down in regions of high density, and this will lead to a self-trapping loop whereby they form a dense phase and a dilute phase. And we wanted to investigate in more detail the analogies between this non-equilibrium phase transition and an equilibrium liquid gas one. And the tools we use is, first of all, Brownian dynamics simulations of very large systems of up to 40 million particles. And secondly, a continuum model a la the Kahn-Hilliard equation, where we use an effective free energy, which we derive directly from the microscopic dynamics in terms of density-dependent propulsion speed. And to the left is a snapshot of the gas-liquid interface in 3D for a particle simulation, and to the right is the corresponding continuum model system. And as you can see, the structure of the interface is very spinodal decomposition-like, so this looks similar to a regular liquid gas phase transition. To the right is the growth in time of the characteristic length scale, which obeys a power law, which it should in an equilibrium phase transition. And also the scaling exponents are very close to the diffusive T to the 1/3 behavior, which is another surprising thing given that this is a non-equilibrium system. And for more details, please come to my poster. Thank you.
Thanks. Our next speaker is going to be Shashi Tampi. Is that speaker here? Okay, good. So then we will continue on with Ben Vollmeyer Lee.
Hi, I'm Ben Vollmeyer-Lee. I'll be talking about anomalous velocity distributions in a model for active Brownian suspensions. It's a different model than the one in the previous talk. Well, here's the reference. This is work done together with Andrea Figa and Annette Tsipelius. The basic ingredients are elastic hard spheres, no energy dissipation with collisions there. They're moving through a medium, so there is a dissipation associated with that. The hard spheres, there's a volume fraction which sets a collision frequency, but this is not thermally driven. There's no Gaussian noise representing thermal driving. Rather, the sense in which it's active is that these have, from some internal energy supply or something, they can kick in a random direction with some frequency, which we'll call F drive. And there's some distribution for the kick size. When you put all this together, there are four timescales in there, one of which is trivial. So we rescale basically so that the average RMS velocity is one, and that leaves three non-trivial timescales: the dissipation rate, the collision rate, and the drive frequency. And so if you measure the distribution of the velocity distribution, you in principle would expect it to depend on all three. However, simulations have shown, primarily the work of Andrea, event-driven simulations find that the velocity distribution depends pretty much exclusively on one parameter, which is this ratio of the dissipation to the drive. So it more or less, large beta means that a lot of energy is dissipated between kicks. A small beta means very little energy is dissipated between kicks. And in particular, there's the collision frequency is not showing much effect. So color-coded here are different values for the beta, and the sort of jaggedy lines are the numerical data. Based on the sort of lack of dependence on the collision frequency, we constructed a single particle theory, and that's actually plotted as well. At least for beta equals 3, 5, and 10. So the kind of smooth-looking lines that emerge out the bottom are the theory, so it works quite well. One thing that's interesting one thing about the single particle theory, you do in the small beta limit, which you can think of as having a large drive frequency, but a small kick size so that you're keeping the same RMS velocity, you basically go to an Ornstein-Rubinbeck process. So you have to go back to, in the small beta limit, maximal Boltzmann or Gaussian velocity distribution. But what you get in the other end, in the large beta limit, you get this emerging universal 1 over 2 beta times the speed regime. That's sort of this curving regime here. It's universal not only in the sense that it depends only on beta and not the other parameters, but also that it doesn't really depend on the kick size distribution. As long as the kicks are isotropic, you get this out. More details at the poster.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to continue on then with our final soundbite speaker, Jenny Ross.
I'm going to, got a little bit of some issues going on there, that's fine. I'm going to tell you about some work we've been doing in our lab with using microtubules and motor proteins. So this is a cartoon of microtubules. They're not really green. This is a cartoon of kinesin motor proteins, and we put them in this configuration so the motor proteins are stuck onto the glass and the microtubules are propelled forward in a gliding assay. Who's heard of a gliding assay before? Not that many of you, okay. All right, and then when we do that, and these movies shall be looping, but they're not, you can, if you do that with low density of filaments and no cross-linkers, then you just get microtubules that can glide. And one thing I wanna point out is that unlike other systems, particularly actin-myosin, our microtubules actually cross a lot. And so that means that when you put them at high density, you don't get large-scale pattern formation as Andreas has shown with, and Justin Molloy has also shown with actin-myosin systems, you get intersections, and sometimes at those intersections you get a roundabout, and so it forces the microtubules into these loops. And so this work is published, was published a couple years ago, and then so we decided what will happen if we force interactions to occur. And so what we did is we added cross-linking proteins. So this is MAP65. It's also known as ACE1. It's also known as PRC1. Biologists suck. They have the different names for all the same protein. I'm a physicist. Okay. So we're using the plant version, which is called MAP65. It's an anti-parallel cross-linker. And so you can see at a low density of filaments, when you have two microtubules glide into each other. So this is the same movie in the red channel for microtubules, in the green channel for the MAP65, and then an overlay if you're not red-green colorblind. And you can see that when the two microtubules come into contact with each other, there's not much MAP65 until they overlap, and then there's a huge influx of MAP65, and MAP65 has a really fast on and off rate, and so they can actually slide past each other. Unfortunately, as always happens in experiment, our movie ended, so we didn't get to see the rest of it. And then if you take this and you now do it at higher density of microtubules, and actually there's another trick here, which is that you pre-bundle the microtubules with the MAP65, then and then you add them to an already active gliding assay. So you're basically putting a condensed phase on top of this active kind of these system of pushers, then you get things that look like cells. And if you show these movies to cell biologists, they think they're cells. So yay, except for the problem is like I can't quantify the celliness of these cells or the stateiness of these cells. So to me, this looks like the overlapping interpolar array of mitosis. Who thinks that? Anybody else? All right, and this one looks like the last stages of cytokinesis. Right, and actually this is where MAP65 is found in mitosis, so I thought that was really cool. But the thing is like I can't go to cell biologists say that that's what it looked like, but I don't have a quantifiable number that says this one is cytokinesis and this one is mitosis. So I'm looking for somebody to help me quantify these images in these movies over time. So if anybody is like a super person who knows how to do that stuff, please come and talk to me. I don't have a poster, so you can just find me. I'm a blonde woman. so I'm easy to find. I'm also a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I have new funding to work on this exact stuff from two different places. I have a grant with Margaret Gardell where we're going to mix actin and microtubules together. It's an Inspire Award from NSF. And then I also have a private foundation funding from the Mathers Foundation to look at these things and add confinement. So if you're interested and you're looking for a postdoc, please come and see me. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Thanks. Okay, so we actually have one last speaker. Tempe is here. Go backwards. I hope there were no biologists in the audience.
We look at hydrodynamic instabilities and topological defects in active pneumatic suspensions. The idea is to model dense suspensions of bacteria or cytoskeletal elements. And what we do is hybrid lattice Boltzmann simulations, and this is a snapshot that you get from such simulations. What you're seeing is streamlines which look quite turbulent in nature, and the color code is essentially the vorticity plot. So you see basically clockwise and anticlockwise rotations of fluid elements. So we see that during the development or towards the development of this active turbulence, there are two distinct stages. To see that if you start from a completely pneumatic configuration, you first see some sort of bent instabilities that's generated, and that's the hydrodynamic instabilities. And because of the flow generated by the active stress, they become stronger, and then topological defects emerge from this. And finally, it goes towards a chaotic regime. What we see is that these topological defects play quite an important role in determining the steady state structure of these systems. In particular, we see two characteristic length scales, a length scale that can characterize the velocity field, and we see that it's basically determined by a balance between activity and dissipation and the defect dynamics. You can identify another length scale which is characterizing the order parameter field and interestingly the vorticity field, and the symbols here are for elasticity constant, a measure of activity, and the number of defects. So for more, please visit the poster. Thank you.
Okay, so I think we're done with our soundbite speakers.